Good evening, everybody, and welcome to once again another review of Arya Deva's 400 Standards. And before we do anything, let's set our motivation tonight for being together. Trying to really see, maybe after these weeks of review, a little bit more clearly how the four distortions truly do keep us bound in cyclic existence. That arising from ignorance, this self-grasping ignorance that not only misunderstands reality, sees it in exactly the opposite way of how it really exists. That these distortions keep us cycling through birth, aging, sickness, and death. Not understanding what to abandon, what to cultivate. And because we misunderstand how reality exists, because we're looking at our lives and the world through this distorted view of the four distortions, is that from them, all this anger and attachment, this pride, fear, miserliness, doubt, jealousy arise. Thinking that our happiness is outside of ourselves, that this, what appears to be a very substantially, inherently existent self, is the center of the universe and whose happiness is of the greatest importance. And from these afflictions, we are propelled to then create all kinds of negative karma, which then once again continues the cycle of birth, aging, and sickness and death. And because we're under the control of ignorance and because we're under the control of these afflictions, we don't really see the dependent arising of ourselves and others. We don't see the causes and conditions, the parts, the mind that conceives and labels this I, anything in our phenomenal world. Because of these distortions, we don't see the extraordinary kindness of all beings. That we have the freedoms and fortunes that we have in this precious human life due to their extraordinary help and support and kindness over who knows how many lifetimes for us to be here right now. And so as we continue on with Arya Deva's verses, let's call to mind that the beauty of the Buddha's teachings is not only did he set out clearly the first and second noble truth of true origin and true cause, the four distortions, the afflictions, the karma, the first and second noble truth, but out of incredible compassion and wisdom and skillful means, he also laid out the third and fourth noble truth, which is true cessation and true path. And that by hearing, thinking, and contemplating these profound teachings, really seeing how they're true in our lives, to see how these distorted views have no basis of reality, and that there is a way out of this cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death through understanding how things exist, to understand the remarkable capacity of our minds once they are freed under the bondage of the four distortions. And that in our deepest hearts we want to really benefit, to get out of this I, me, my, and mine universe, and to expand our good hearts to encompass the well-being and the welfare of all. And so the Buddha set forth a beautiful path, and Arya Deva describes it clearly in these chapters. And so tonight may we really listen and contemplate the teachings so that we can really begin to create the causes and conditions for our own liberation and awakening. And to do that only, not only for our own happiness, our own permanent peace, but for the well-being and the liberation and awakening of all living beings. Let's really hold that tonight, the great capacity of these wonderful minds and hearts of ours. and the profundity of the Buddhist teachings that really help us to develop that fully, completely. So we are moving on. Aryadeva's 400 stanzas are divided into four sets of chapters. The 400 verses are divided into sets of four chapters, each one having 25 verses. And so we've gone through the first four major divisions, which were the four distortions. And I have to say that he just kept driving home week after week, verse after verse, how much these misconceptions are the cause of cyclic existence. And that, you know, I've been thinking about them a lot. It's been really kind of a sobering experience. But not sobering in a way that I feel really depressed or really despondent about it. Sobering because what he teaches us is just how it is. And that I came to realize how much the distortions really run my life and how they cause a lot of problems and a lot of confusion. And the beauty about the chapters is that not only does he show us sort of the crazy thinking that's behind these four distortions, all the ways in which we try to justify seeing things that are by nature impermanent as permanent, things that are by nature the cause of dukkha as happiness, things that are by nature impure and foul as clean, and those things that which by nature have no self as having a self. He just kept kind of every angle that we could possibly have to justify continuing to think like that. He was just kept shooting them down with just this remarkable logic and reason. So after a while, I could see like this crustiness in my mind starting to kind of crack open and kind of soften a little bit. So I have a lot of gratitude in my mind for the reviews that we've been doing and for Venerable, out of her kindness, really giving these teachings. So what happens in the next four chapters is that he presents a totally different reality from the four distortions. Which is really the true nature of how things do exist and how we can achieve it, which is this beautiful mind of bodhicitta, this awakening mind. And he will talk a little bit about how there are some of the things that get in the way of engaging in the bodhisattva deeds, how to abandon them, and then how to really fully train in the bodhisattva deeds. And doing chapter 5, which the subheading for that is the actual meaning of how to train in the deeds of the bodhisattvas, you really get a sense how utterly outrageous and remarkable bodhisattvas are. And they have amazing compassion and courage and fortitude. And that's all because they've eliminated the four distortions and the karma that is created by them. And so tonight we're going to get to, by going through the verses, we're going to get to see a little bit how a bodhisattva's mind works and what really propels them, because it's not the four distortions, it's this wonderful, vast awakening mind. And the other thing I have to say is that besides the teachings that Venerable gave about 2.5 years ago on the grounds and paths of the Mahayana paths and grounds, on how bodhisattvas, what they have to meditate on, and the different afflictions and the different obscurations that they eliminate. After those teachings, there was something that shifted in my mind that I started to see that through logic and reasoning, I could really start to see how the path to awakening is possible and that the way that the bodhisattvas traveled is indeed the way. So after I finished with chapter 5 here, I have to say that I am convinced that they not only exist, I mean, my confidence and my faith in the existence of bodhisattvas after reading this chapter grew very much, but that they are in our world and they are totally focused in benefiting us all the time. I mean, there's something like visceral in my mind, in my body right now, after reading this, these verses, and listening to Venerable's commentary and Ari Davis' commentary, that has somehow grown my faith in their existence. Because there are Buddhas that exist, and the causes for Buddhahood are the Bodhisattvas, and so we'll get into that a little bit later. And that what we're doing right now with these teachings, if we listen to them sincerely, if we think about them deeply and meditate on them, that we are creating the causes and conditions to have the minds and the bodies of Bodhisattvas. That's another piece that's kind of gotten quite a bit more strengthened from doing this review. And that the other thing that became very clear to me, in kind of a funny way, and Venerable Chu said it, she kind of gave me a little bit of a smile when I was telling her about how when I look at our teachers and I see some of the things that they do, this is their handbook. When I see the way His Holiness teaches and how He is with the world, when I see Lama Zopa, when I see Geshe Zopa, when I see Venerable, when I see Dagri Rinpoche, when I see Khenpo Jompa Tegtok, all of the teachers that we have met here, and I see the way that they relate to us and the way that they teach and their incredible fortitude and incredible love and compassion, it's like this is their handbook. And that really, and I don't know if they're Bodhisattvas, I don't have that kind of understanding, but they are following. There's a lot of, in these verses, there's a familiarity. I've been in the presence of people who practice like this, that really try to do this, and so I feel really inspired. And so I just have, my faith has really increased in the belief of the Bodhisattva's existence. It's just been a very joyful experience doing this. So I want to share that with you tonight. Okay, so the subheading for Chapter 5 is to how to train in the deeds of Bodhisattvas, having generated engaging bodhicitta. So according to the four previous chapters, if you're someone of the fundamental disposition, what you do is you use the four distortions to meditate on. You generate the aversion to cyclic existence in order to seek liberation. So folks that are wanting to become arhats, they use the four distortions and their dispositions. That's where they go. They develop that deep renunciation and that wish to be free from samsara. If you're a person with a Mahayana disposition and you've developed compassion, when you see the four distortions, you grab the idea, you understand the idea that it's not only us that are trapped under the influence of these four distortions, but that all sentient beings are in cyclic existence along with us. And so we increase our great compassion and we really go towards wanting to develop bodhicitta and wanting to attain awakening. So depending on what our karmic dispositions are, these four distortions grow us in particular directions and support us by understanding, you know, how to eliminate them. So in the first verse, Joe Blow is back and he asks, well, what are the causes for Buddhahood? Where are they found? And the first few verses in this really show the greatness of Buddhahood, which is the resultant attainment. This is what Bodhisattvas are aiming for, and this is the result. And Venerable quotes Chandrakirti in his homage at the beginning, saying, this is the homage at the beginning of the supplement to the Middle Way. He says, not only Bodhisattvas' attainments, but all attainments of the hearers and solitary realizers, and actually any virtue that sentient beings create, originate in the Buddha. And it's true in the sense that it's the Buddha who taught us how to create virtue and what to abandon and what to cultivate. And so the Buddha is actually found in the teachings, and that the causes of Buddhahood are all the virtue and all the attainments that all sentient beings garner for themselves. And then Joe Blow says, well, what is the Buddha like? And so we begin with verse 101. And the first few verses are just talking about the Buddha's qualities and what their capacities are. So the first verse, not a single movement of the Buddhas is without reason. Even their breathing is exclusively for the benefit of sentient beings. So Buddhas make no physical, verbal, or mental actions without the motivation of being of benefit to sentient beings. And there are different ways in which Buddhas benefit. And so this first verse really asks us, as Venerable says, is to try to go beyond our intellectual mind and to start using our creative symbolic mind, because the visualizations on imagining the powers of the Buddha are really set outside of kind of our intellectual parameters. So the first one that's stated in the commentary is rays of light come from the Buddha's feet, and they cool the burning heat of the sentient beings in the hell realms and free them from that suffering. When the Buddha breathes his breath, it forms a rain cloud above the hell realms, which shower down rain that soaks the fires of hell. And this is the profundity and the skillful means of the Buddha, that the hell beings, for even just a moment, admire and are grateful for what he has done. And by that one virtuous thought, a seed is placed in their mind stream that is in accord with full awakening, simply by appreciating his kindness, even for a moment, that they have already begun turning, already creating the causes and conditions for their awakening. So even the Buddha's breath is for the temporal and ultimate happiness of sentient beings. So for those who have interest in our own good, we should have faith in the Buddha. And so Joe Blow, who's in all of us, says, now if the Buddha is raining down water to cool the fires of the hell realms, and this was back in August of this year, it's really dry here in Newport right now. We could use some rain. So how come the Buddha doesn't make it rain in Newport? Or, as a matter of fact, I have this disease. How come the Buddha doesn't find a cure and cure me? How can the Buddha benefit me? And the response is, the hell beings have created the causes, but we haven't created the causes to receive that kind of benefit. So then Joe Blow comes back again and says, but rays of light from the soles of his feet, cooling the burning heat of the beings there and alleviating their suffering, isn't that kind of like fairy tale language? I mean, that doesn't kind of, I mean, is that real? And the response at that point in the teachings when I listened to them was, isn't it a lovely thought? That to imagine that from the soles of someone's feet, the suffering of beings can be eliminated. Even the thought, if we could take that and imagine what that would be like, could really inspire and really soften our minds and really open up our minds. Whether it's proven by science or not, it's not important. And Venerable does, she talks about this a lot. She says it's good for us just to relax around the scientific logic and reasoning and to let this beautiful, symbolic, creative language of our minds think, wow, isn't that amazing? What if that were true? And imagine being able to do that, to be able to cool the fires of hell by the breath, by one's breath. And then she says, well, if I'm ever going to be able to do that, I guess I should start being nice to the people I live with. And so what it does is that having these kind of beautiful, expansive thoughts, whether true or not true, they really inspire us, gives space in our minds to think beyond the box of, you know, if we can't see it, it doesn't exist. And what Venerable says, which is quite interesting, is that she says there's a certain amount of arrogance that maintains the view that if you can't see it through scientific means, then it doesn't exist. As if everything exists should be discernible by scientific instruments. But science only has the capacity to measure the external world, not the internal world. Scientific measurement instruments can't measure karma. They can't measure the extremely subtle mind. And that, she says, what's helpful for our practice is to expand our ideas of what exists and not to have it be confined by just what our five senses can comprehend. And she said, as a matter of fact, when we watch our kitties here at the Abbey, every once in a while, and Manjushri used to do this a lot, he'd come into a room and he would sit transfixed, watching something in the room. And I would look up in the ceiling and I would look around and I'd see absolutely nothing. There, you know, there are things that are evident to other beings. There are things that beings can't see. But just because we can't measure them by instrumentation, it doesn't mean that they don't exist. And then verse 102 says, just as ordinary people are terrified by the words Lord of Death, so the words Omniscient One terrify the Lord of Death. So the word death, for most of us, we tend to get a little bit nervous when we hear it. It's a word that has a lot of meaning, can be very, very powerful. And when people hear the words Omniscient One, it can inspire anyone who hears it. And just to imagine what it would be like to have an omniscient mind plants the seeds to actually be able to attain that. And then when Aryadeva says that the Lord of Death is terrified of the Omniscient One, What he's referring to is when we attain nirvana, is sometimes called the deathless state, because when we attain nirvana, we are actually the causes for birth, aging, sickness, and death in samsara are ceased. So that's why it's called the deathless state. So if you are not born in samsara, you can't die in samsara. Therefore, it is deathless. So then Joe Blow says, well, good motivation. The Buddha, he can do those fancy things. The effect of the Buddha's actions are really good. But to say he's omniscient, I'm not quite sure. After all, when he was alive, there were 14 questions that he never answered. Now, I think, Joe Blow says, I think that means that he isn't omniscient. He might be, you know, have to do some fancy, miraculous things, but he's not omniscient. Like, he didn't answer the question, are the self and the world permanent or impermanent? Is the soul permanent or impermanent? And the way that Venerable spoke about this, she said, just asking the question presupposes, first of all, that the soul exists. Okay. Is the world eternal or not eternal? That question presupposes that either it goes totally out of existence without any continuity, or it exists exactly right now as it always has and always will be. The people asking these questions asked them based on the assumption that things truly exist. So does a person exist after death or not? Once again, if you're coming from a view of true existence, you can't answer the question because neither of those things are true, because there's no such thing as an inherently existent person. So when verse 3 says the subduer has the perception that which should or should not be done or said, what reason is there to say that the omniscient one is not all-knowing, is that to the people who ask questions like the ones mentioned, it was through an incredible skillful means and due to his omniscience that he didn't answer them. Because you're not going to be able to give them the answer that pleases or helps them to understand if they have that view. And that actually the fact that the Buddha didn't respond establishes his omniscience, because the Buddha perceives the right time or the wrong time to say this or that to some sentient being. He knows the right and wrong time to do different actions. He knows what's beneficial now. He knows what's beneficial later. He knows what's harmful now. He knows what's harmful later. And because of his omniscience, he knew that by asking those questions, it would not serve those sentient beings. It was not the right time. They were certainly not in the place to understand him. And therefore, it really does say that it verifies, and instead of disproving his omniscience, it proves his omniscience. And so what it shows is that he had an extreme sensitivity and a care for those sentient beings' minds. And by not responding to those questions, he wasn't going to further confuse them in their wrong views. Verse 104 explains how to practice the bodhisattva deeds, which are the cause for Buddhahood, especially the feature of the motivation for training in the deeds. And when speaking about the motivation, showing that the mind is the principle of the three doors. So basically it's saying that to practice the bodhisattva deeds, which are the cause for Buddhahood, the mind is the most powerful tool to be able to accomplish that. And here it very simply says that without intention, actions like going are not seen to have merit, and so forth. And all actions, therefore, the mind should be understood as paramount. This is pretty much all about motivation. That for all the things that we do that we consider to be neutral, if we can somehow just turn them to be like those beautiful gotchas that we have, to turn them into a virtuous action, we can accumulate a lot more merit by simply sort of enhancing our motivation from being rather a neutral one, like washing the dishes and going through the door, going up the stairs, having lunch, is by setting them into a virtuous motivation. Instead of not collecting any kind of merit, we actually can accumulate vast amounts of merit in what would ordinarily be a neutral action without no karmic result, rather than just it happening, arising, ceasing, and passing away. And that the mind is pretty much the determining factor on whether the motivation is going to be virtuous or non-virtuous. Now, what Venerable says is that, you know, when we grew up, we weren't taught to really think about why we do what we do as small children. We were more taught about, you know, how to get away with things, how to look good with in front of people, how to impress, how to be attached to our reputation. So she said there's really quite a process for us to start thinking about motivation and why we do what we do, because we don't have the general cultural paradigm raised in that way. Verse 105, showing that even what is non-virtuous in others becomes supremely virtuous in bodhisattvas by the power of their motivations. In bodhisattvas, through their intentions, all actions, virtuous and non-virtuous, become perfect virtue because they are in control of their minds. So this one basically says that because of their profound bodhicitta motivation, that bodhisattvas can actually do things like killing, stealing, lying. And because of the motivation, because it is done conjoined with emptiness, is that they don't create any misdeed, they don't create any negative karma because of the powerful control of their minds and because of the bodhicitta motivation. And there's that story about him being, you know, the captain of the ship with the 500 merchants, and one of them wanted to kill all the others, and so he set about with this intense motivation to prevent that one merchant from accumulating this horrendous karma from killing all the others, is that he actually took the life of that one merchant and took on the karma of that killing. But of course there was very little. I think the story later on says that when that karma ripened, he was in the hell realms for like, I don't know, a few seconds. Now for us ordinary beings, we don't have that same power, we don't have that same motivation. And that we sometimes justify our negative actions using the Dharma in kind of a funny, you know, inappropriate way. Like going home for Christmas, and I'm going to go have a few drinks with my family, because if I don't drink with them, they're going to really have a poor sort of view about Buddhism. So if I have a few drinks with them while we're sitting around the dinner table, then they'll be, you know, happy that I'm joining them and I'm feeling like I belong, and then I can share the Dharma with them. Like, we don't have the wisdom, we don't have the skill to be able to do non-virtue with a bodhicitta motivation and not get away with creating non-virtue. So we're not at that point, but bodhisattvas are. So this is one of the abilities that they do have, to be able to do non-virtuous things and not create non-virtue. They still create amazing amounts of virtue. Okay. We're going right along here. We're going to skip all the way to verse 108, because there is a lot in here. The actual mode of training in the bodhisattva deeds, specifically physical and verbal conduct, and how we accomplish others' benefit with our body and speech. The verse reads, "A spiritual guide who wishes to help must be attentive towards students. They are called students because of not knowing what will benefit them. So on the first two lines, Venerable says the spiritual guides are referring to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And this is one of their really remarkable skills, is that they need to understand sentient beings. They need to know all of our dispositions, our tendencies, our inclinations, what we're strong in, what we're not strong in. And to create this great merit, they have to be very, very sensitive. And to be able to teach us, they have to know where we are. And so what she said, because every once in a while in these verses, she would say, well, this is what the bodhisattvas can do, but where are we at this point in our practice? So how sensitive are we when sentient beings want to talk to us? Do we ever really listen to them about what are their likes and dislikes? What really inspires them? What on the path do they like? Do they like to study? Do they like to practice? Do they like emptiness teachings? Do they like bodhicitta? We don't really take the time to see how they see the world, how they really think. We form an idea about what's good for them, and then we kind of pretty much put it out there, whether it's what they like or what they're receptive to or not. And so the last two lines that they say they are called students because of not knowing what will benefit, this is very good to remember, because when we're students, it's always good to realize that, oh, I'm receiving these teachings because I'm not really wise, and sometimes I need good advice because I get confused and I don't understand what to abandon and what to cultivate. And she says, similarly, if we're in the role of leading sessions or here at the Abbey when we do these reviews or we do sharing the Dharma, things like that, is to really have an open mind, thinking that the people who are hearing us may also need to have some support, may need to have some advice and encouragement, and that we're all not Buddhas yet, to not have these kind of expectations that what we're saying and what we're sharing, that people are going to get it right off the bat. In fact, Venerable says that when we share the Dharma, is to not expect anything, to really keep our hearts and minds open. We don't know how it's going to be received. All we can do is just really have a heart that wishes to benefit and to do the best we can. And that training varies according to needs, aptitudes, places where people are struggling, where they're strong. What applies to one person doesn't apply to another. And and that we need to be sensitive and use our wisdom. And so once again, this is in these verses, Venerable talks about what the bodhisattvas are capable of, what our teachers and spiritual mentors do, and then what we can learn from modeling and watching them. So she kind of continually steps it down, saying that what the bodhisattvas are doing, we can also practice at the level of whatever level we are to grow our sensitivity and to grow our skillful means. And as the verses go on, bodhisattvas being very sensitive and being very astute at what the capacities and the inclinations and the dispositions of sentient beings proves to be one of their most powerful assets as bodhisattvas, among many others. Okay, verse 109, specific attitudes to have to do the bodhisattva training. Just as a physician is not upset when someone who rages while possessed by a demon, subduers see disturbing attitudes as the enemy, not the person with them. So this is just once again using the analogy as a Buddha as a physician, is that he has his capacity to see the afflictive states of mind, to see the ignorance, but to have this incredible compassion for the sentient being, to be able to actually separate the behavior, the afflictive state of mind, from the sentient being who wants to be happy. Someone who's stubborn, who won't listen, the Buddha sees that it's just the afflictions that are getting in the way. And that, once again, Venerable then, you know, steps it down and says, you know, and the same with us, is that when we get angry with each other, when somebody's upset, when somebody reacts, is not to take that response personally, but to understand that at that moment, the person is suffering under the afflictions of anger or attachment or jealousy or confusion, and to be able to have some compassion, to be able to be there and support and listen and to offer some sort of care, rather than personalizing that anger and then just fueling the whole scenario. So she says it's so important, especially here, you know, living in community, we know each other's afflictions. We know each other's strengths. And so to be able to encourage each other, to be able to support each other, and not take one, you know, some of us are under the control of our afflictions, to not take them personally, but to be able to stand there with compassion and with some patience and some understanding. Okay, let's see. There's so much. Verse 110, verse 111, once again, continuing to state that one of the strengths of the bodhisattvas are that for which someone has liking should first be assessed. Those who are disinclined will not be vessels for the excellent doctrine. More about skillful means, more about being able to discern where sentient beings are and how to benefit them. Being compassionate towards those with strong afflictions, just as a mother is especially anxious about a sick child, bodhisattvas are especially compassionate towards the unwise. And, you know, bodhisattvas, I mean, they don't, I mean, when they meet up with sentient beings who lack total, don't have any wisdom, don't know how to make wise decisions, and get into a lot of trouble, and when they teach them and they do the exact opposite way, unlike us, who get, you know, frustrated, and after the second time we've had a reaction, we just say, forget it, I'm out of here, no way. The bodhisattvas just, and the Buddhas, they just like, it's okay. They understand, they're so compassionate, and the more volatile and the more stubborn and the more afflicted a sentient being is, the greater and the deeper their compassion and the more their focus and their undivided attention on wanting to help. I mean, they're not discouraged, they're not scared away, they're not intimidated by sometimes this outrageous behavior that sentient beings pull off, that, you know, and all the arguments that they hear on why, you know, people don't want to create virtue. They never get fed up, they never get discouraged with us. They're just, their fortitude is immeasurable. And so what Venerable says here, well, if the bodhisattvas haven't given up on us, maybe we can start thinking maybe we shouldn't give up on others. Once again, she steps it down and says, okay, how can we take this profound bodhisattva deed and apply it to our own practice and start working on, you know, how do we deal with difficult situations? Okay, I'm trying to pace myself here because there's so much to go. Okay, this one, verse 112, how to act for others' welfare according to their capabilities and inclinations. Some bodhisattvas become students of some and become teachers of others. making beings who do not understand, understand through skillful means and knowledge. So this is where bodhisattvas will become students, will become teachers, will become friends, all wanting to teach. And she even said in this one that they even appear as leaders of other religions, if it will benefit them. So if it benefits them to believe in God and to practice ethical conduct, to please that God, they'll do it. And this is where, when we study the grounds and paths, that we hear that the bodhisattvas have to learn every philosophical school, every practice, every ritual, every theology, is that if they're going to be leaders of other religious traditions, they have to know the kapathe, they have to know the theology of that religion. So they can be rabbis, they can be bishops, they can teach anyone and everyone. Now, as newbies, we can't do that. If we go and try and learn practices that we're not familiar with, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, all we're going to do is get confused. So what she recommends is just we really stay very clearly on one path, get deeply, deeply a strong foundation in that. And then after quite a long time, when we've got a very strong basis and foundation of our own practice, then she says, then you can explore other type of traditions. And that she also shared here the skillful means of some of her teachers. Because when she was a baby nun, and she hung around, she had Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa as her teachers and Ling Rinpoche, she said she struggled so much with jealousy because it appeared that the disasters, the most volatile, the most irascible students were the ones that were closest to the lamas. They were the ones who served them tea, traveled with them, cooked for them. The lamas kept them very, very close. And she was always so perplexed and always so jealous. But why do they have these students that are so difficult around them? You know, I'm a little bit more cooperative. Can I kind of close into the circle? And that as years went on, she said, it was extraordinary to actually be clear about the incredible kindness. And that those students, despite their irascibility, despite their afflictive states of mind, had some very, very strong karma with Lama. They had some cultivated some faith in the teachers. And so the teachers, out of this incredible kindness, kept them very, very close. And then, of course, at that point in the teachings, all of us here at the Abbey said, well, we must be the disasters because here we are so close to our teacher here at the Abbey. But I don't know whether that's true or not. But, you know, to understand that our teachers aren't afraid of dealing with the difficulties. They're not afraid of dealing with the difficult ones. They don't get discouraged and frustrated like we do. Okay, then, verse 113, just as for an experienced physician, a sickness that cannot be cured is rare. Once bodhisattvas have found their strength, those they cannot train are extremely few. This one I never knew before. This is really quite a profound one. This is the one in regards to the four ways of gathering disciples. Okay, so although it's not a blanket statement, due to aging, sickness, and death, many wise, and once again it's the analogy of the wise physician and the Buddha, the bodhisattvas, is that a very wise and experienced physician who has learned through hardship, through listening, through logic, reason, really being there for their patients, they're really able, as the years go on, to benefit more and more people. They don't get easily stumped by difficult symptoms. They infrequently do wrong diagnosis because they've got a view of all the different things that they've seen. They've sort of taken that all and consolidated it into a very, very deep wisdom. And so just as these experienced physicians, there aren't a lot of diseases that they can't treat on some level. So it is with the bodhisattvas, that they have developed the capacity to mature or ripen sentient beings and can benefit limitless amounts of sentient beings. And what this means is that the ripening is that they help sentient beings by teaching and guiding them to create merit, which will ripen in the future on their ability to be more receptive to receiving the teachings. So there's this, through all of these verses, you see the bodhisattvas just complete focus. If I can make a connection, if I can show the Dharma, if I can teach even one piece of Dharma to a sentient being, I've made a connection. Their entire existence is to connect with us, to somehow give us one little piece of wisdom, one little piece of the Dharma. They've developed great compassion, so their skills, like the experienced physician, are great compassion, the wisdom that not only knows reality as it is, but the wisdom that comes from skillful means that knows how to benefit. And so because they don't shy away from anybody, there are very few sentient beings that they can't help, so, as long as they make the connection. So there are the four ways of gathering disciples. And once again, when I first heard these, I was a little bit suspect because my own ordinary mind, with its worldly motivations, said, well, how come bodhisattvas, why do they give presents and why do they speak nice to people? And why do they, you know, tell them about their good qualities? Because my mind would go right to like worldly concerns, when in fact bodhisattvas don't have worldly concerns whatsoever. They're first one to be generous with them. They give material aid because they want to, once again, connect. Everyone enjoys receiving gifts, receiving presents. It helps to make a connection. It draws sentient beings close to them. So they're doing it for a totally different reason than we do. Speaking pleasantly, they're friendly, they're kind, they point out good qualities, they have a sense of humor, helps sentient beings to develop a trust in them. Once again, pulling them close, getting them near. Giving encouragement to lead them on virtuous paths by teaching them the Dharma. So once again, anything that they think will help, support, guide, encourage. And then the fourth one, which I think is probably the most powerful of all, is live the teachings by example. They walk their talk. So whatever they're going to ask us to do, they embody it themselves. But with our ordinary minds, many times we do the exact opposite. We're stingy, we're critical, we're sarcastic with our speech, we ridicule others, we call them idiots, we discourage them, we say one thing, we do another, we're hypocritical. And, you know, being who we are, who's going to follow us? I mean, how can we ever garner trust from other people if we behave like that? So you can see that, you know, we have a lot to learn, and that we're going to, you know, we're not going to be able to draw anybody to us if we don't learn how to really use our body and speech in a way that benefits. And once again, we can see our teachers, how warm and genuine, how generous, how welcoming they are with everyone. So we can do a lot here to train our minds to be more like our teachers and more like the bodhisattvas. Okay. All right, I'm going to go to the super knowledges. This is where it gets fun. Okay. Verse 117. The suitability of cultivating appreciation for bodhisattvas, especially the deeds that are difficult to perform. As the bodhisattvas go along the path, they take on more and more hardship, they take on more and more difficulties, more and more sentient beings, they manifest more bodies, their emptiness deepens, their bodhicitta is just so pristine, so immense. And then they start getting these particular capacities. One who in all lives has the five super knowledges appears as inferior with a nature like the inferior. This is extremely hard to do. So the bodhisattvas have attained forbearance in the five super knowledges, and they don't decline because they're based on the direct realization of emptiness and bodhicitta. And because of this, they can take rebirths to benefit any beings, higher rebirth and lower rebirth. So they can appear as a bee to benefit bees. They can appear as a yellow jacket to benefit yellow jackets. They can appear as a turkey to benefit turkeys. They can appear as a turkey to human beings to benefit human beings. They can, you know, I mean, they can show up in any kind of form. They can appear as anything just, and the inferior rebirths is where it says that they're very, very difficult to do. Because the kind of courage and the kind of powerful mind to be able to voluntarily go into the hell realms to benefit even one hell being, you have to have an extraordinary mind. You have to have a very deep understanding of emptiness, and your bodhicitta has got to be so powerful, your love and compassion have to be so great. Okay. They manifest beyond our comprehension in order to somehow open sentient beings' minds even for a little bit, to be even a little bit receptive. Because what happens is that once the bodhisattvas make those connections with us, in future lives, that karmic connection will continue, provided we haven't, you know, cause some sort of hostility towards the bodhisattva. And even then, we still have a karmic connection. We never lose that karmic connection with them. But if they make those connections in future lives, they can continue to meet with us, guide us, encourage us, support us, without us even knowing it. You know, they're not out there wearing name tags saying, I was a bodhisattva in last life, and I met you, and here we are again, so don't screw up, you know, listen. They don't do that. And the difference in their five super knowledges is that there are a lot of people in our world that have some of the super knowledges. They have an ability, they have clairvoyance, they're able to read, you know, people's minds on some level. Some people are able to do sort of super normal things, you know, levitate and things like that. And they have these super knowledges because of previous karma or through their concentration. But it isn't sustained because they don't have the direct understanding of emptiness conjoined with bodhicitta. So after a lifetime or so, that just diminishes and they pretty much lose those super knowledges. So I'll go over those quickly. And then Venerable thinks that the forbearance that they refer to in the commentary here is referring to the forbearance of the first ground bodhisattvas, where one has the choice to go wherever one is needed and to have the courage to do it. They don't fear emptiness. They can take any rebirth they wish because they are no longer bound by afflictions and karma. Although they're not entirely free, because not until the eighth ground are they really free of the more subtle obscurations, they still have this incredible courage and they don't fear emptiness. They don't fear suffering. I mean, they're just not connected to it. They're just totally overjoyed in being able to do this. So the five super knowledges. First one is miraculous powers. They can walk on water. They can fly through the air. They can go beneath the earth. They can levitate. The divine ear. Hear what other beings are talking about in different places, including hearing teachings in other realms. So we could be listening to His Holiness's teachings right now in India. Knowledge of other people's minds. And this is not an intellectual ability. Like, they're not thinking, well, what are those people thinking? They're having a direct perception. They're actually hearing the thoughts as they arise in the sentient being's mind. And then you can see why it would be important to have compassion. Because if you didn't have compassion, you could do some real damage to yourself or to that person whose thoughts you're reading. So it's very important that bodhisattvas, they have this great compassion. Take looking at those thoughts, and that with compassion you could guide them because you know what to say that would be congruent with what they're thinking. So rather than teaching them something that isn't going to work, because you're being able to read their minds, you know what they're thinking, you know the kind of way their train of thought is going, therefore your teaching could be very, very appropriate for what they're thinking. The fourth one is recollection of previous lives. Bodhisattvas use this to see where their teachers and past lives are so that they can reconnect with them. And as well, they see where their students were from past lives. Because they have a karmic connection with them, they will try to track them down and continue to guide them. And the part about this verse, which I found so remarkable, is even bodhisattvas are going to look for their teachers, and they're going to connect with them to continue to learn. It's not like once you become a bodhisattva, I don't need any more teachers. They go and they look for them so they can continue to practice and continue to receive teachers. So when we think about the teachers who came to the West, like Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, Geshe Zopa, Geshe, what's his name, Wong, the one in New Jersey? Wong Gyal. You know, Venerable said, you have to think that they must have had some sense of the karma that they had with all of us, to give up all that they had, all that they knew, to come to this country, not speak the language. She says that, you know, she was curious. She said, I wonder if they had some sense of the karmic connection that they had with all of us Westerners for them to make that journey and to come here and to learn the language and to teach us. And then there is actually a sixth super knowledge, which is found only on the liberated eighth ground and above. This is called the destruction of the pollutants, the afflictions, and the fetters. You know from your own direct experience that you're able to destroy the pollutants, afflictions, and fetters, that they have been destroyed and they will never return. So there's something about the knowing that that's done, completed, and that you have that understanding. The fifth one is the divine eye. Thank you. Seeing beings in other realms. They're passing away in their rebirths.
And which state is are these five accomplished?
The path of seeing, you start on the first ground. Okay. Okay, because there's just some of them that I didn't. Yeah, it's just so wonderful. Okay, I'll go to verse 121. Why bodhisattvas can accomplish all their deeds. For one who before even did ill deeds, they have no effect. There is nothing one with virtue considers should not be accomplished. So this is another thing that I've always found inspiring, is that they used to be ordinary beings, these bodhisattvas. They created lots of misdeeds. They did all the 10 non-virtues. But at this point on the path, all the imprints won't be able to produce effects due to the extent of their purification and accumulation of virtue. So when we're doing our purification practices in the hall using the four opponent powers, this is what I said this morning in the hall, is that we're impeding the force of the negative karma to ripen, and when we create merit by practicing virtue, we dilute the force of those negative karmas so they ripen as small sufferings. So after a while, the bodhisattvas don't ever experience the negative results of whatever karmic latencies are still in their minds. They also will stop at nothing to benefit us. They will benefit us temporally. They'll give us food. They'll give us clothing. They'll give us shelter. They do it for the sole motivation on the long-term view of leading us to awakening. And things that they do for us that appear in a worldly way, once again, we come back around, they do it to make a karmic connection to us so they can be with us in the future. They always try to connect with us, to connect us to the Dharma, whether it's with a worldly gift, whether with some sort of activity, some sort of travel, some sort of engagement, so that they plant the seeds of kindness in our minds, so we actually get kind of inspired by being with them, that we think more kindly, we get inspired, we start thinking about virtue, and that we will be able to be in practice with them in the future. So no matter what they're doing, they're always thinking, what can I do right now, if it looks like I'm making them breakfast, how can I make a connection, how can I put a little seed of virtue in there, so that will ripen in the future and that we have a connection for the future. I think that's the fact that they're always trying to connect to us. I find that to be an amazing idea, an amazing thought. And then Joe Blow says, well, the next subheading on verse 122 is why bodhisattvas don't strive just for their own happiness. Joe Blow says, well, since Arya bodhisattvas are entirely virtuous, and aren't born in samsara due to ignorance and polluted karma, why don't they just remain absorbed in the sphere of nirvana? Why don't they just call it good? And the verse says, even here nothing harms one with a powerful mind, and thus for such one, worldly existence and nirvana are no different. So even though, because they have these incredible minds, and they have this incredible, powerful wish to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of others, they don't ever create the slightest wrongdoing. Even though they're right in the middle of all of this samsaric wildness, there is no way that they can create non-virtue by being here. They are not tainted by its faults, and this is where the symbol of the lotus represents the bodhisattvas, in that the roots of the lotus are down in the mucky muck, down at the bottom of the lake, but the beautiful, exquisite flower is growing up in the sunlight at the water's surface. So even though the bodhisattvas got themselves in the muck of samsara, their minds are so strong, their motivations are so pure, that they're not harmed by samsara and they're not tempted by it. And for bodhisattvas, they're not afraid of anything. So for them, there's no difference whether they remain in worldly existence, benefiting us, or that they go and hang out in the bliss of nirvana, because they're in bliss all the time. It doesn't matter to them. So in their minds, rather than staying in bliss, why don't I manifest countless bodies in samsara and benefit as many sentient beings as I can? The experience for them, nirvana, living in the world, benefiting us, the bliss is the same. This is their magnificent promise to all living beings, is to stay with us until no living being remains in samsara. And they love doing it. I mean, the joy that they have is immeasurable. The merit they collect, even Buddhas can't measure it by doing what they're doing. Okay, verse 123. Why bodhisattvas can take special physical forms. Well, because of the amazing control they have over their minds. And you know, this past year, I have to say that one of the things that Venerable has been saying to us on more than one occasion is that she says, we practice because we need strong and happy minds to practice, to benefit. I can't tell you how many times this summer she said, we need to practice to have strong and happy minds, strong and happy minds, strong and happy minds. And through this whole commentary, what we keep hearing is that bodhisattvas have these remarkable, strong and happy minds. So once again, here's our teacher giving us a bodhisattva training, saying that we have to practice because these strong minds to realize emptiness conjoined with bodhicitta, to be able to take these rebirths, to be able to benefit, to have the skillful means to know where people are, where sentient beings are. I mean, strong mind, strong mind, strong mind. And then the verse, 123, is why should anyone who takes birth through constant control of their minds not become ruler of the entire world? Now, this is just such an ordinary being's question. This is Job Lowe's question. Oh, this is the verse, actually, after Job Lowe says, okay, now how is it that they have all this mastery? Why don't they want to just, like, take over the world? Okay, so here they are. They're on the path of seeing. They've realized emptiness directly. They have this remarkable control. They can take rebirth and worldly existence wherever they wish, in whatever form they wish. So given that, you know, why would they want to become rulers of the world and have dominion over all of us? They're not interested. They're simply not interested. They're not interested in being universal monarchs. They're not interested in being kings. They're not being interested in being powerful CEOs. Their minds are so subdued, their mindfulness and their introspective awareness is so perfected, there's no ignorance, there's no attachment, there's no anger, there's no afflictions whatsoever, just great compassion, wisdom, skillful means. They have no reason to rule. You know, why bother? The other thing that I thought about is that through all of these verses, the bodhisattvas are trying to meet each sentient being where they are, to teach them and guide them, whatever their inclinations, whatever their dispositions. So there's this personal one-on-one relationship that bodhisattvas want to have with sentient beings. If they're the ruler of the entire world, there's no way that that can happen. Now, so there's something to be said about receiving teachings in person, you know, to be able to go someplace and to receive teachings and make connections with teachers, because there's this individual connection that bodhisattvas make. So they don't have any interest. They don't want to rule. They have more fun meeting us one at a time, face to face. Verse 124, proof of the resultant state of omniscience. What is the result of doing the bodhisattva deeds? Even in this world, among excellent things, some are seen to be most excellent, thus realize that certainly also inconceivable power exists. So how do we know the Buddha has this kind of power? How do we know the bodhisattvas have this kind of power to manifest bodies, to know sentient beings' dispositions, to be able to give them the exact teachings they need? How does the Buddha know that? So Aryadeva says that you can get some idea of the result, Buddhahood, by looking at the causes that bring that result. So in our world, some excellent things seem to be more excellent. You can see something that is really good, has causes and conditions that are really good, and you get a really good result. If you get even more excellent causes and conditions together, you're going to get even a more excellent result. So the result is concordant with the causes. So when you look at the deeds of the bodhisattvas and see how they practice and all the amazing things they do, then you get an idea of what an omniscient mind is like. And Aryadeva says, the fact that omniscience exists is because all the deeds of the bodhisattvas are the causes for the omniscient mind. The inconceivable power of bodhisattvas definitely exists because of the three countless great eons of their accumulation of the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom. You can just imagine They're all those causes. Then try and imagine what kind of effect they would bring. So here tonight we've heard all about these incredible, outrageous, amazing things that bodhisattvas do. And what those causes are the causal, they are the causes for the resultant attainment of awakening. The more excellent, the remarkable excellence, and then this excellent, omniscient, beyond excellent, omniscient mind. So then you can see how causes and conditions bring results, and that the bodhisattva deeds are the causes for awakening. Oh, and then we get to Venerable, she just got, this is so great. Spending time thinking, really contemplating what bodhisattvas do for us, manifesting, and she just goes on with this, and I kind of embellished it because it is so true, and it just brings them into this space in my mind where I just want to just do prostrations. They manifested all kinds of lives to try and connect with us and teach us and guide us, taking all of these sometimes horrible rebirths to do so, putting up with all the nonsense that they get from us, seemingly dragging us, kicking, screaming, and biting to enlightenment. Because in our ignorance, we argue with them. What's wrong with samsara? What's good with, you know, orange cake and brie cheese and sleds and warm, comfy beds and families and friends and going on adventures and having lots of fun? What's wrong with it? Sleeping with my iPhone. Why do you always want me to create virtue? How boring. I mean, the bodhisattvas run up against this all the time with us. And when you see what they had to put up with, I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. I mean, would any of us put up with some of the nonsense that we give? Some of the crazy thinking, some of the stubbornness, some of the indifference, the apathy, the righteous indignation, the laziness? Would we ever be able to tolerate that if we were trying to help somebody? Just forget it. I'm out of here. And what they say, the bodhisattvas never give up. They say, okay, you're not receptive now. We'll try another way. Maybe we'll wait a few eons, but I'll try again. I'm not going to give up on you. Therefore, the result of Buddhahood must be even more amazing when you think about what they do to guide us to awakening. And then the last one, verse 125, it shows why those with poor intelligence fear the Mahayana. So Joblo says, why are people afraid of the Mahayana or at least uninterested in attaining Buddhahood? The Venerable says, you know, she goes on with this wonderful little example that says, okay, so you meet the Dharma. You're really excited. Wow, I've been waiting to meet something like this all my life. It's just the way I've been thinking, the questions I have, it seems to be answering all my questions. But I was thinking, it shows a path for me to follow. It lays it right out. So then you go and you start telling your friends and family, and they're not the least bit interested. In fact, they kind of look at you kind of funny, like you might have lost your mind or you're kind of off on some trip somewhere. So the verse is, just as the ignorant feel afraid of the extremely profound doctrine, so the weak feel afraid of the marvelous doctrine. And this addresses the fact that some people who hear the teachings on emptiness and dependent arising, which are the profound doctrine, get afraid thinking that they'll cease to exist, that the self-centered thought and the grasping itself inside the mind really gets scared by hearing the teachings on emptiness. And for some folks, hearing the teachings on the bodhisattva deeds are kind of scary, that whole idea about going to the hell realms to help them, taking three countless great eons to become a Buddha, that people really think that they're totally, that it's daydreaming, that it's totally unrealistic, it's too hard. And there are some that simply say, well, I'm going to liberate myself. Besides, omniscience doesn't really exist. So what Arya Davis says, if you want to liberate yourself, fantastic. By all means. I'm going to advocate not giving up. And he tells us on the way, you know, tells us the importance of the bodhisattva path. And of course, him being Nagarjuna's heart disciple, you have to think he probably knows something about the bodhisattva path. So Venerable also explains how the weak that fear the profound and marvelous doctrine, they are beings that lack merit and are therefore unreceptive. And you know, we know that some of the teachings, we just can't meet them, we get resistant to them, we get confused about them. It's because we haven't cultivated enough merit, that there's a receptivity of our minds that isn't yet nourished yet? That many times we're simply too self-absorbed or lack the ability to think critically. And she said, surprisingly, her experience has been that people that have very, very high IQs, that have PhDs, that have very, you know, important, very scholarly professions, she says that a lot of times they can't connect to the Dharma for anything. That a lot of the times they think that, you know, what exists is pretty much this body and mind, and so the teachings on omniscience and rebirth, they can't quite connect to it. And that the abilities of the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas make them very uncomfortable. So what she's saying is basically is that the intelligence that the Buddha talks about, you know, the inferior and the advanced level practitioners, it's not about just intellectual intelligence. It's about this receptivity. It's about this curiosity. It's about the willingness to practice and to have fortitude and curiosity. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a wizard, you have to have a high IQ. And that, and sometimes that actually becomes an obstacle to receiving the teachings. Okay, so in conclusion, this is what Arya Davis sums it up as. Having considered the faults of cyclic existence, we'll enter this vast and profound Mahayana of which those with poor intelligence feel afraid and make the bodhisattva deeds your quintessential practice. That encapsulates the whole path. It includes meditating on impermanence, the unsatisfactory nature of samsara, the foulness of the body, and the lack of the self. It includes contemplating the thoughts around taking rebirth again and again under the control of afflictions and karma. So go directly to the Mahayana. Do not pass go. Do not pass collect $200. And endeavor to accomplish the bodhisattva deeds that will bring awakening and to rejoice, Venerable says, that we have the amazing fortune to be able to hear them, to be able to practice them, and to go about doing that with a very joyful mind. So we are extremely fortunate to have the teachings. And I don't know about you, but after thinking about this and after reading about these verses, I am just so delighted that bodhisattvas exist, and that they care about us the way that they do, and that I look forward to the day, the life, sometime as in countless great eon in the future, that may we all be able to have those qualities, may we all be able to have that kind of fortitude and that kind of outrageous courage that never gives up on any sentient being. We'll go to the hell realms for one sentient being, as Lama Zopa says. So may we really be able to take Arya Deva's beautiful, profound verses to heart, so we can become bodhisattvas. And it's really the only thing left to do. So anyway, have a wonderful evening. When you go to bed tonight, just imagine your entire, every atom of space in your room is filled with bodhisattvas. On every molecule of air, every particle of matter in the universe has got a bodhisattva on it. So, good night. Thank you.